It's 6 after 9. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The July-August issue of the Atlantic Monthly is all about ideas. Real-world attempts to rethink big questions. One article in the magazine offers 11 and a half ideas that, according to the Atlantic's editors, most informed the national conversation over the last 12 months. We're going to spend the next 50 minutes or so talking about them. As you listen, you will, I hope, want to chime in with your own ideas, and here's how to do that. Toll free, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Email is also welcome. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. My guest this morning is Scott Stossel, Managing Editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Good morning, Mr. Stossel, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, why 11 and a half ideas and not 12?
Well, good question. We wanted to, when we began the process in December of trying to come up with a list of the biggest ideas of the year, we actually had no preconceived notion of how many ideas we wanted to end up with. In fact, at one point we were thinking it could be 50. And then as we started going through the list at one point, which you know extended as long as I think we had about 150 ideas under consideration at one point, we narrowed it way, way down to 10. Then we realized we couldn't quite fit it into 10, and we thought also 10 is just too conventional a number. And we wanted to, so we ended up with, we were sort of toggling back and forth between 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. And as we narrowed it down and narrowed it down, we wanted these all to be ideas that in some way really did inform the news and inform the national discussion over the last year. But we also wanted to convey that this exercise was not an exhaustive or you know completely scientific thing, and so that you know, but by going with 11 and a half as opposed to 12 or 11, we were conveying some whimsy. And also, the last idea, the 11 and a half idea, we figured was an interesting kind of partial idea, but it didn't rise to the level of being a full blown big idea. And that's to say that this was the notion that it's lonely at the top, as exemplified by all of the politicians this year who were caught in kind of illicit adulterous liaison. So,
who fell from grace, so to speak.
Precisely.
What was the process? I mean, so you came up with these 11 and a half ideas. Then did you just ask people to write articles about them, or were the articles already there and you were just picking them?
Nope, it was actually somewhere in between. We came up with, as I say, at one point we had about 150 ideas that we were sort of weighing as possible top 10 or top 20 or top 50 ideas. We narrowed it down to probably about 25, and then met again. This was over a series of meetings over about 4 or 5 months, where we just kept hashing them over again and again. And we went out, and we came up with about 20, and then assigned all of those 20 to different authors based on their areas of interest and expertise, and also trying to make sure that we had a diversity of points of view. And then once we, and of those 20, about 18 ideas materialized as written pieces. And then we were sort of informed by how those turned out. How convincing was it that, you know, any given idea was a big one? There were some that narrowly missed making the cut. The inevitability of universal health care was one that we almost had on there. Congestion pricing, a piece about, are biofuels evil? And in the end, so it was kind of a mixture. We came up with, preconceived ideas, assigned them to authors. Then when the authors' write-ups of these pieces came in, we reconsidered them again, and that's how we ended up with the final 11 and a half. And then once we had those, the order was not set. So we spent many hours over several days ordering and reordering the list.
So how did you order them? I mean, are they presented in some sort of a rank order, highest to lowest? Or, I mean, is there a number one idea and a number 11 and a half idea? How did that work?
Yes, we ranked them from biggest to smallest. And, at various times we knew we wanted an ideas list. and other magazines do, you know, ideas of the year, but it raises a question of definition. When we were talking about a list of ideas of the year, does that mean the best ideas of the year? Could it be the worst ideas of the year? We ended up settling on biggest ideas of the year. So even that raises questions. What does big mean? And the way it's a vague definition. To some extent, we were kind of governed by the famous Justice Potter Stewart definition of pornography, which is you know it when you see it. But we went for ideas that informed the national discussion, as I say, and that sort of played out across the headlines, sometimes on the front pages, sometimes a little bit in the background, but were nonetheless kind of percolating along in a recurring fashion, and oftentimes sort of signaled some kind of fundamental change in how we think about an issue or how we think about ourselves. And so, we ended up ranking them 1 to 11 and a half, with number one being the biggest idea, that is to say the one that was most dominant or most important or in some way had the largest impact on the greatest number of people, down to ones that were smaller. And, I mean, this was hotly debated within the ranks of our editors. I mean, not everyone, I think, in the end would agree that, you know, mass market atheism, at which we ranked at number four, really should have been above number five, which was We Torture, the kind of recognition that American government has sanctioned torture in the course of the war on terror, or that sort of carbon consciousness, this notion that we sort of become aware of carbon footprints and trying to reduce the our carbon impact on the atmosphere, and the idea that we could actually at some point be free of a carbon economy. Should that really be ahead of the end of 9/11? It should it really be behind the return of regulation, which was number seven? So it was it was a source of great discussion and debate within the magazine, and we hope it prompts further discussion outside of the magazine, and we welcome people's input.
I was listening as I was listening to you describe the process. I was reminded of the old semantic game called "How often is often?"
Right.
You know, how many are a few? How large is big? I would like to have been a fly on the wall during some of those discussions, because I would imagine they were probably very interesting.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean, it becomes, we purposely in the end, I mean, even the, we argued over definition, and how precise should we make the definition of big? How precise is the definition of idea? I mean, when you come down to it, what is an idea? You know, this is part of our ideas issue. We were fairly broad in our conception of idea. It's a thought or a policy or a concept or a way of reframing, a way of looking at the world. So we ended up being, you know, it allowed us to have a wide range of things included in this list. There was no set agreement or no consensus among the staff, so we hardly imagine there will be among our readership.
Well, and I would imagine that would be a desirable outcome for you, would be to have your readers debate and discuss this as well, and disagree or agree or whatever. You want to stimulate discussion.
Precisely. I mean, we aimed to, you know, we wanted to come as close as we could to some kind of consensus, and to be responsible in and accurate in ranking these things. But we recognize this is just kind of a starting point, and so, you know, we invite readers to come to theatlantic.com to vote on our rankings or to submit their own list. And in fact, we've got a little page set up on our website for people to submit their own ideas, and we'll actually be selecting from among those and printing them in a future issue and online.
And this is sounds like a perfect moment to invite our audience to chime in with what they think were the big ideas of the past 12 months, and here's how that can happen. You can go to the phone and call us toll-free, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's a local call for you. Please call us at 227-2050, 227-2050. Or you can use our email address. Here it is, talk@wpr.org. I'm talking with Scott Stossel, managing editor of The Atlantic Monthly, and we're talking about the July-August issue of the magazine, which contains 11 and a half great ideas. I'm paraphrasing there. Let's talk about. Let's start from the bottom up. The 11.5 idea. You talked about you mentioned it a little bit, but let's just talk about it a little. The article is titled "It's Lonely at the Top," and this is this recounts the experiences of a number of prominent people who tumbled thanks to some indiscretion or some indiscreet activity on their part.
That's right, and the article reads in its entirety. So it's Lonely at the Top, exhibits A through G. Elliot Spitzer, obviously the deposed governor of New York, Larry Craig from Iowa, David Vitter from New York, Kwame Kilpatrick from Detroit, David Patterson also from New York, Antonio Villarosa from Los Angeles, Vito Fasella, and David Vitter was from Louisiana, Vito Fasella was from New York. And the reason we gave this only a half idea, we realized as we were thinking back over the past year, I mean, in part we were sort of looking, we wanted this list to be kind of a thumbnail intellectual history of the last year, and we realized that sex scandals are not a new phenomenon. Certainly they're as old as human history, probably. But it seemed like for some reason this year there was a sudden a profusion of them. And, we struggled with what's the idea underlying this? I mean, is this, a lot of these scandals involve prostitutes. A lot of them involve, they all involved extramarital liaisons. We could have included James McGreevy, who had been the governor of New Jersey. But we actually at one point had a longer essay sort of articulating an explanation or a possible explanation for why you had this proliferation of sex scandals and what it meant. But when we read it, we realized it was sort of unsatisfying and sort of, and that simply listing, simply pointing out the large number and range and prominence of the folks who had falls from grace, as you put it, was really sort of interesting and, must bespeak some underlying idea, but we're not exactly sure what it was. So, is it just that it's lonely at the top? Is it that power either is an aphrodisiac and arousing the amorous desires of these politicians, or is it that it's no longer an aphrodisiac? And this is the famous Kissinger formulation: power is an aphrodisiac. Many of these men's downfalls involve paying for prostitution, which suggests it's not enough of an aphrodisiac that you weren't you didn't have to pay for it. So that was kind of the rationale behind that 11 point.
Are we shocked by this kind of thing anymore? I mean, or do we just expect it? I know, in the 90s, we were still capable of being shocked. I'm wondering if we've lost our ability to be surprised by this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it sort of seems like, after a while, you become jaded. I mean, I think, again, the Elliot Spitzer thing shocked pretty much everyone, just given how prominent he was and how brazen his behavior was and how huge and tragic his downfall. But I mean, I think the last, you remember back to the late 90s when, you had the President of the United States, being impeached really over things relating to his dalliances with an intern. And then in quick succession, you had, successive speakers of the House, Newt Gingrich, who, had affairs, and then his brief successor, Bob Livingston, having to step down for the same reason. And I think that's the last time you had such a profusion of big named sex scandals in such a short period of time. But yeah, these they recur with enough frequency that it seems only to confirm the hypocrisy of moralistic politicians, or the fallibility of human nature, or the weakness of the flesh, or I don't know, all of the above.
Well, it also illustrates how the measure you use will be used against you. So if you're going to condemn somebody for having a problem in that area, you can expect the same coming back at you.
Exactly.
If you want to call that karma or whatever, I guess there's probably a number of names for it. We're going to talk about the other 11 issues. First, we're going to take a short break. We'll see if somebody wants to join us by phone. And we're talking about issues of the last 12 months that have informed our discussion. They could be good ideas. They could be bad ideas. We're talking about a list of 11.5 of them. that will appear in the July-August issue of The Atlantic magazine, and we have the managing editor of that magazine with us this morning to talk about that, and you can too. You can join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or 227-2050 if you're calling from Milwaukee, 227-2050. If you want to put your idea into an email, you can do that as well. Send it to talk@wpr.org. Well, what do you think should have been some top ideas from the last 12 months? And give us a call and let us know what your thoughts are on this, and we'll let you talk about it. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Twenty-three minutes after 9 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today. Mary Jo Wagner's in for Ben Marins today. The news that's been in the week that was. At issue after 4, it's your views on the news. Mary Jo Wagner will be in for Ben Marins. You can call in with your thoughts on the week's top news story after 4 o'clock today here on the Ideas Network. This morning, in this first hour of the program, we're talking about 11 and a half ideas, and actually we'll be talking about more than that because I'm sure you'll have your own. 11 and a half big ideas that, according to the editors of The Atlantic, most informed the national conversation over the last 12 months. We've talked about that one half of an idea, and so far, and we're going to move on. First, I want to make a little bit of a correction here. I think Larry Craig was incorrectly identified as being from Iowa. He's from Idaho. We don't want the people from Iowa to come across the border and invade us for that. So get that straight. My guest is on the phone with me, and you can be too at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. Scott Stossel is managing editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Okay, so let's go to idea number 11, which is it's an article titled "The End of 9/11." Explain that.
Well, this is a concept, and it's by James Fallows, one of our national correspondents, who's actually written about this indirectly before. And it's the idea that after 9/11, the cliche, but it was a cliche that happened to be true, was that nothing will ever be the same again. You know, after planes had flown into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon, and thousands had died, we'd been attacked on American shores. You know, nothing could ever be the same again. And all discussions of politics, foreign policy, national security, civil liberties would take place in a new context that could never be the same again. And to some extent, that remains true and will always be true, possibly forever. But there's also a sense in which the kind of era of 9/11 expired, and perhaps Jim in his article, Jim Fallows, points to the failure of the candidacy of Rudy Giuliani to really take off as the kind of official death knell of the era of 9/11. I mean, his candidacy was predicated largely on his being kind of a 9/11 president, his heroic and reassuring behavior right in the aftermath of 9/11 was kind of what he built his candidacy on, and the fact that it didn't go anywhere and sort of surprisingly crashed and burned suggested that not every conversation can begin with "on 9/11 everything changed."
I have never understood that, and maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm a little slow on the uptake, but I guess I would be somebody who, when people were saying, "Oh, everything's different now," I'm going, "Like what?" I completely didn't get that, but maybe I haven't been eating the right breakfast.
Well, it's the era of 9/11 is in some ways what changed our airport security measures, and that's something that's not going to change. I mean, anyone who's flown any time in the last 6 years knows that the different experience from flying, from before 2001. It certainly informed our decision to go into Iraq. It's informed all kinds of formation of Department of Homeland Security. It's led to calls for more national unity and bipartisanship, which haven't really been.
Yeah, how's that working for you?
Yeah, that's working great. And now there's a lot of experts, national security experts, who actually talk about how You know, thinking it always in terms of you know, a 9/11 era is tactically stupid. You know, even in terms of winning a so-called war on terror. You know, recently another thing that Jim Fallows points to in his article is that you know, in 2007, a British cabinet member announced that his government would stop using the term war on terror because it sort of dignifies. Or elevates the terrorists, you know, where it's something where, you know, it gives them too much credit that we have to wage war against them. I mean, it's a bunch of kind of disparate criminals.
Well, that's actually that's not anything new for the British, I don't think. It seems to me that during the so-called Troubles, as they were euphemistically described in Northern Ireland, they refused to describe some of the perpetrators of the violence as terrorists. They were treating them as common criminals because they didn't want to elevate their status or make them seem more heroic.
Exactly, and I think that gives the British a more sophisticated understanding of how to handle this kind of situation. And the real danger, though, I mean, the thing that I think Jim Fallows worries most about, that he's gesturing at in his article, is that obviously, there are, you know, we live in a dangerous world. There are terrorists out there. 9/11 did change things in a fundamental way, and yet there are certain things that make America strong and sort of what we are, and that you risk if you go too far in you know, suspending civil liberties, or if you go too far in restricting individual liberty, if you go too far in torture and that sort of thing, not only does it make us less American, but it also makes us less safe. It's not simply an idealistic thing; it's a national security thing. And that's you know, maybe we've finally gotten to the end of the era of 9/11, where not every foreign policy discussion has to begin or be predicated completely on, you know, we were attacked on 9/11.
The idea number 10 is about our carbon consciousness. Did you see before you start? Did you see yesterday the Bush administration issued not a press release, but their statements about this flooding indicated that there was a direct relationship between that and climate change. I thought that was worthy of note.
Yeah, and sort of a reversal there too, that there's at least a tacit recognition that. You know, what we do as humans with our fossil fuels and our you know, other technological and industrial activities has an effect on the environment that can kind of come back and bite us in ways that might not be good. In Carbon Consciousness, which is idea number 10, Megan McArdle, who's one of our associate editors and a blogger, talks about, you know, carbon, that's not a new thing. It's the building block of life, so it's been around for hundreds of millions of years, but it's really in the last year, and this is why we included it on the list, that it's you hear about, you know, the talk of reducing carbon footprints, or just kind of consciousness of what carbon does. I mean, basically, you know, fossil fuels, we sort of you know, we snap carbon bonds to harvest their stored energy, and all of a sudden we're realizing, as she puts it, that you know, these gifts of energy that have powered the Industrial Revolution and you know, all of the world for the last 100 plus years, we're now certainly finally getting serious about returning that gift for a refund. And there's a bunch of reasons for this. I mean, she says, one, it's, you know, this, as you alluded to, you know, the science of global climate change has gotten harder to argue with. You know, the evidence is mounting. It's not 100% conclusive. Not everyone agrees that there's a direct correlation between, you know, fossil fuels and climate change, but there's a pretty strong scientific consensus. And second of all, you know, through various market mechanisms and scientific research into alternative technologies, it's at least possible to start to imagine, you know, what you might call a post-carbon economy. We're not there yet. We're a long way from there. And you know, the recent sort of failures of biofuels are a setback. But, you know, we know, I think it's becoming more conventional wisdom and accurate conventional wisdom that something has to change. We need to get beyond fossil fuels and heavy coal dependence or oil dependence.
Well, we're already seeing the effect of $4 plus per gallon gasoline on the American motorist. We seem to be driving our cars less, which I guess could be considered a good sign. We are finally getting the picture on how much fuel we should be using.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we're finally getting priced. You know, we're hurting in our pocketbooks enough that anyone who wasn't paying attention to the cost of carbon, now they are, because you can't avoid it.
Okay, let's. I tell you what, let's go to the phones. We'll take a call. One of our listeners has an idea that he thinks is worthy of discussion, and maybe this came up in your list as when you started out with over 100 of these, and you whittled it down to 11 and a half. Maybe this one came up. Let's take a call from Ken in Neillsville. Ken, good morning, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The best idea I've heard in 8 years is the impeachment of President Bush for falsifying evidence to get us into a war, invading a country, and then lying to the American people to keep the war going and sending our troops into harm's way unprepared and without a decent strategy. There's so many reasons that this guy should be punished for his crimes and what he did to the American people and to the troops. It's just a shame that he gets away with it, and I think something should be done about that. And I just think that would be one of the best ideas I have heard.
Okay, Ken, thanks for that call. Well, that idea has certainly been raised. We saw Dennis Kucinich on the floor of the House of Representatives actually introducing articles of impeachment last week. Of course, Nancy Pelosi immediately said they weren't going anywhere.
Yeah, and it's interesting, we did consider that idea in various kind of permutations. Either the impeachment of President Bush, we ended up that never, Kucinich was the one guy on the run prominent political figure who actually raised the possibility. We decided in the end that it hadn't, it may be a good idea, but it wasn't something that was such a part of the national discussion. It was sort of more on the fringes, so we didn't end up including it. But we did also toy with ideas along those same lines and on completely contrary lines. Along the same lines, the idea of George Bush, the worst president ever, is that an idea that has sort of emerged as a topic of discussion and something worth considering? On the flip side, we have other people arguing, is there a possibility that actually history, 50 years or 100 years from now, will actually vindicate George W. Bush? That would certainly be more controversial if we had gone with that. If things sort of turn around in Iraq and if it's hard to imagine now, but suddenly the Middle East democratizes, and is it possible that history, Truman at various points in his presidency had dreadful approval ratings and was felt to have botched things in Korea and so forth, and now has been somewhat vindicated. Is it possible to imagine that Bush will be treated by history in the same way? I mean, personally, I find that a little bit hard to imagine. And in the end, we decided that none of those ideas quite, in terms of how larger role they played in the national discussion, didn't rise to being in the top 10, but we did talk about those. So it's certainly an idea that's out there that your listener proposes.
Well, we've gone through up to 10. Now let's drop down to number 9. You've got not bombing Iran.
Yes, and this was an idea, and this was a little bit of a controversial one on our staff. After Iraq and for the last few years, and this is actually a nice follow-on to your caller, there's been a sense fairly continuously for the last few years that the Bush administration has been rattling its sabers at Iran, and there's this sort of implicit threat that we might bomb them, or that Israel might, in order to take out their incipient nuclear program. And that's sort of been on the table, for ever since 9/11, really, but particularly for the last few years. What changed dramatically in the last year was a few things. One is that the Bush administration has been so discredited in terms of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that everyone questions how good is the intelligence that it's using, how is it manipulating. And then second of all, there was this report that came out from the National Intelligence Estimate in December that said actually Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program a few years ago, and this really changed the complexion of the debate here in this country about whether bombing Iran can still be on the table. In this piece, which is by Jonathan Rauch, I mean, he makes the point that actually nothing has changed in terms of Iran's aggressive stance. Nothing has changed probably in their desire to have a nuclear weapon. But the notion that bombing Iran is an imminent thing by the United States, that's changed fairly dramatically.
800 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're calling us from Milwaukee, 227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about a series of articles appearing in the July-August issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and they're all about ideas, real-world attempts to rethink big questions. And there's a sort of a top 11 and a half list. We're going through it. We've gotten through down to number 9. We're counting down to number 1. And you can join us with what you think. What was the top idea? Not the top news story. Let's talk about the top idea. Something that informed our thinking, that dominated our consciousness about a specific issue. What do you think the top idea was in the last 12 months? We don't need to go back farther than that. Think about the last 12 months. The top idea, as far as you're concerned, during that time period, and call us and talk about it. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 are the numbers to call to join our discussion. Well, now we're down to number 8, and I think we probably have to move along a little quicker if we want to get to number 1, and I'd like to spend more time talking about that. We have this one I found particularly curious, personal genomics.
Yes, and this is one that's a little bit of an anomaly in this list in that it was a big idea. It's been an idea that's bumping along for a few years, but its promise, its potential, or its danger won't be fully realized for a little while yet. So, in that respect, it's a little bit anomaly. This is by Charles Mann, who's a science writer and a regular contributor to The Atlantic. And basically, personal genomics is this notion that you can have an individual or a medical patient, in effect, spit into a cup and they can get your DNA from it and figure out your individual molecular makeup. And then kind of look at a database of the human genome and figure out, what diseases are you susceptible to and what are the best ways to treat, whatever ailment you may have, how do you treat that in a special tailor-made way to your molecular makeup, your genetic makeup. And this has all kinds of implications for business and sort of controversial. There's these startup companies that are starting to cater to this, but again, it hasn't yet translated into treatments that can cure patients, and so this is something that's probably not going to be fully realized until down the road.
The return of regulation, idea number 7.
This is one that this is by Clive Crook, who's a former editor at The Economist and an economics expert, regular contributor to The Atlantic, Clive Crook. This is obviously in the aftermath of the mortgage bubble bursting, all these banks failing, and the Federal Reserve and the federal government in general stepping in to basically not allowing things to fail. Clive talks about how in the 80s, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher sort of ended the era of regulation. The deregulation was in vogue. Now, after all these banks have failed, there's a increasingly powerful notion that you need some more regulation. Someone needs to be overseeing these banks. If a Democrat is elected, if Obama is elected, you'll be more likely to see even greater regulation. So the sort of subprime mortgage crisis, as well as a number of other factors, including the downturn of the economy, have really changed the complexion of the thinking on regulation. And so regulation is back. That's a big idea.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have some callers who want to join us, and there's still a line available for you if you call right now at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. If you get a busy signal, send us an email, talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what we're going to be talking about next hour. We'll talk about how to handle rudeness in everyday life and stop the cycle of bad behavior in society. That's coming up next hour. This hour, we're talking about an article or series of articles in the Atlantic Monthly all about ideas. How appropriate that we're having this discussion on the Ideas Network. My guest is Scott Stossel, managing editor of The Atlantic Monthly, and he joins me by phone, and you can too, and so are a number of other people. So I'll give the phone numbers one more time, and then we'll take the calls that we have waiting. 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. Those are the numbers you can call. A couple of lines available for you right now if you hurry. Let's go first to Brad in Duluth. Brad, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me on. Good morning. It's a great topic. My idea, or the idea that I think is probably important to the discussion, national discussion, is that for the first time in my life that we've been seriously taken the white, English-speaking, middle-aged male out of the center of the discussion as far as where we go, as far as leadership potential, and, you know, the electorate is looking outside the box. And race and gender have not are not the issues that they were or have been all along. And I'll take the response off the air.
Brad, thanks for that call.
No, that's a really good point. And in fact, we have a bunch of in our collection here of the 11 and a half biggest ideas of the year. We also have a bunch of side lists, and one of them is newly conventional ideas we used to think unimaginable. And the very first idea on there is viable non-white or non-male presidential candidates. And it's amazing how quickly we've sort of come to take it for granted that, you know, the front runners in the Democratic primary were a black man and a woman. That's astonishing, and Brad is absolutely right.
Let's see, another idea, number, let's see, we talked about the return of regulation, number six.
Number six, yes.
MySpace. Huge phenomenon.
Well, it's MySpace politics, and in particular, it's you know, it's actually a fairly simple idea that one reason that Barack Obama was able to beat Hillary Clinton is that he was better able to capitalize on these new technologies of social media, using the web, using the internet, using Facebook, using MySpace, you know, what they call in short Web 2.0 to connect, organize, inspire new voters. And, you know, Barack Obama, his fundraising has been enormously successful. And so Josh Green, who's our senior political correspondent, and has written about this at length elsewhere on our pages, basically says, you know, this is a huge idea, this ability of being able to harness social media in order to not only campaign effectively, but it may also translate into a whole new way of governing, you know, using the internet. So he may be the first, Obama's the first truly internet candidate.
Let's see, Why We Tortured, number five.
This is by Andrew Sullivan, who is a blogger and a senior editor for us. And Andrew makes the point that the last 12 months were the point where we sort of reached a tipping point in our understanding of acknowledging that we actually did torture. I mean, you know, obviously Abu Ghraib, as a story broke a few years ago, there have been allegations about things that took place at Guantanamo, at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. But all of a sudden now, as he puts it, the myth of American torture has become the fact of American torture. It's starting to become an irrefutable fact that at various times we have you know, arguably stepped beyond the Geneva Conventions and certainly ventured into what some people would call torture. And that's a big deal for, you know, us as Americans, because that's not supposed to be what we're about. On the positive side, Andrew points out that those who sanctioned torture or who were in defense of it have been sort of been rebuked. So the candidacies, again, of Giuliani and also Mitt Romney failed because they were the sort of chief defenders you know, torture as an American tactic. And so as Andrew puts it, you know, we learned in the past 12 months that America crossed the Geneva boundaries in the years after 9/11, but we also learned that America has the resources to correct itself in the end. So we're ending up in a good place there, we hope.
Number four, mass market atheism.
Here's an idea that, I mean, one could argue that this should be idea number one, because is there any bigger idea than does God exist or not? In a cosmological sense, that's probably the biggest idea. But what our author, Ross Douthat, who's a blogger and a senior editor for us, is talking about is that over the last 12 months, and a little bit longer than that, actually, there's been this proliferation of books on the bestseller list, you know, really in a fashion not seen for 100-some-odd years since the Victorian era, where you've got Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, and there's a new book out there now, all of them bestsellers, all of them much talked about, sort of arguing either the case for atheism or the case against God. And, you know, this is a fairly major you know, cosmological shift. Ross argues that this has to do with kind of trends towards secularism in the United States. And it'll be interesting to see what the, you know, this is sort of a backlash against the overreaching of the Christian right. Now the question is, will there be a backlash against the backlash? And obviously, you know, religion.
So what would you call that? Would that be a frontlash? Or
I guess it's a frontlash, or it's, you know, it's come all the way around.
An eyelash, or, you know.
Just a
okay,
lash.
Let's. Yeah, lash. Number three, post-partisanship.
And this is an idea. You know, we put this issue to bed before Barack Obama had sealed the nomination. But obviously, his candidacy. This is a big reason why this idea ranks so high. His candidacy is premised on this notion of, obviously, he's running as a Democrat. People argue that he's a liberal, but all of his rhetoric and really the sort of animating idea of his candidacy is that he represents a new kind of politics, you know, getting beyond red states and blue states and, you know, just getting to the United States. And Jonathan Rauch, the author of the piece, argues that this is he argues that it's both a common phenomenon, this sort of appeal to post-partisanship. You know, Michael Bloomberg, Barack Obama, Arnold Schwarzenegger are three kind of avatars of this yearning for post-partisanship. He says, on the one hand, it's slightly a vacuous concept, because what does post-partisanship really mean, and has it ever really been successful? On the other hand, it does represent a real yearning. I mean, we're a centrist country with incredibly polarized political parties, and so actually this campaign, this general election, is going to be very interesting, because each in their own way, John McCain and Barack Obama demonstrated a willingness to kind of buck party orthodoxy and to reach across the aisle. And, you know, is this the era of true post-partisanship?
Okay, the number two, renting. Now, this was one I have to say I didn't get.
Well, the article in its entirety, again, it's by Clive Crook, is enough said. And what that's meant to convey is, you know, if you're trying to buy a house, or more to the point, if you own a house, and if you've been following its market value, or if you're paying your mortgage, it's the benefits of home ownership, which have sort of a core part of the American dream, have been called into question for the first time. The decline in home values over the last, say, 3 or 4 years has been so dramatic, particularly over the past year, that maybe we'd be better off renting. And certainly in terms of the impact on the American economy, the bursting of the subprime mortgage bubble has had a huge effect. So it's meant to get at this notion of, you know, renting is an idea, and maybe the idea that renting is a better value, and not so Europeans tend to rent more than Americans. Well, maybe the Europeans are onto something, because I've watched the value of my house decline, as I've been trying to sell it, I watch with sinking heart as its value declines and declines.
Well, I live in a part of the country where we never really had the housing bubble, so that hasn't been a real big deal where I live. But I can imagine renting as opposed to owning a home. I mean, as long as the roof doesn't leak, who cares? Let's see. Let's do the number one issue, and then we got some people on the phone who have their own ideas on what ought to be on this list. James Fallows shows up again with an article about the surge.
The surge. And when we started the discussion back in December, we actually very early on came up with, maybe the surge is the biggest idea of the year. Actually, we're dealing with various permutations on it. You know, the surge is a failure, or the surge is working. What's the sort of the most interesting, provocative idea here? At various times, we actually sort of downgraded it and moved it down. So, it sort of receded into the background. Iraq has actually moved off the front burner. But in the end, when we really thought about it, Iraq still is one of the biggest. It's the biggest foreign policy issue for the next president will have to confront. It's the biggest foreign policy issue, even though it's a little bit starting to drop off the front page, that the current president's having to deal with. And we live in the era of the surge. General Petraeus, more than a year ago now, and President Bush, sort of escalated the troop levels there. The idea was we were supposed to bring to bear on Iraq a kind of new thinking of on counterinsurgency, and that we would do this smarter and better with more troops. As Jim argues it, and I'll just read what he's written here, here we are a year after the surge began. More U.S. troops are in Iraq than when it started, and the argument for keeping them there has descended into a circular reasoning. Either the new strategy is working so well that it can't be interrupted, or else things are so precarious that the U.S. can't afford to withdraw now. And his concluding point is that really the surge as an idea and also as a kind of military policy was meant to kind of break the kind of logjam that we had in Iraq, trying to improve things and change things, and to change the conversation too. Whereas everyone was talking about, what do we do about Iraq? Do we stay in? Do we go out? Well, the surge was supposed to be a third way, and his point is that we're back to nothing has changed.
I thought the whole purpose of the surge was to create a situation where the Iraqi government could take over its own management.
Well, this is the idea, and Jim is, I think, skeptical that will happen. But yes,
well, that clearly hasn't happened.
But it does become a little self-fulfilling prophecy that those who defend the surge will say, well, we're moving toward that, and they certainly can't govern their own country if we withdraw. It'll descend into chaos, and Iran will move in. On the flip side, those who are against the surge will say, if we don't leave, or we don't at least set a deadline for leaving, there's no incentive for the Iraqis to kind of take control of their own destiny in their own country. So we're sort of propping them up and continuing to send Americans into harm's way for an unwinnable war, an unwinnable situation.
Well, that point may become moot if there's no agreement to either if there's no extension of the UN mandate or no bilateral agreement with the Iraqi government on the presence of U.S. troops there or anybody else's troops by the end of the year, as I understand it. Let's go to the phones and let's take a call next from Ken in Milwaukee. Ken, good morning.
Good morning. I thought one of the ideas that really had some tremendous impact is one that I had been thinking about, and I actually talked to a number of people on national level as best as I could, some senators and even one of the former energy secretary, Spencer Abraham. I had a chance to talk to him over the phone one time on a call-in program, and that is doing something along the lines of a Manhattan Project type of push towards a petroleum alternative,
mm-hmm.
getting industry, science, and government together in one spot and pushing towards a true petroleum alternative. This has been such a huge overriding issue in our economy and everything else that we're doing.
Oops, I think we lost Ken.
Well, I agree with Ken. Actually, that's a terrific idea, and we did that was on our initial list. And the only reason we didn't include it, to be honest, was that it wasn't that idea has been talked about now for at least 4 or 5 years. And so we were trying to figure is there a justification? Was that an idea that in the last 12 months sort of achieved new relevance or resonance or something, or that surged to the forefront of American consciousness. And in the end, we decided that there was nothing particular about the last 12 months that made that idea particularly germane. But I absolutely agree that it's a good idea. It's an important idea. It's an idea that a lot of people have been talking about. And it's actually, I think, in various ways already being put into effect. I mean, I don't know if there's one Manhattan Project for alternative fuels, but there's people looking into wind power, hydrogen, biofuels, it's a very current idea, and you can imagine that would be idea number 12 and a half or something like that.
Well, let's give Kurt in Lake Geneva the last comment or question of the program here from a listener. Anyway, Kurt, go ahead.
Thank you. I was thinking that the major thought, not only immediately because of the comments or the strategy of Barack Obama of using a nebulous change as a theme for his candidacy, but on a continuing basis, change the question of whether or not it's necessary, to what extent, and how is a concept that is always popping up in our society. Do we need to change our Constitution? Do we need to have a jurist that is going to interpret the law so that it keeps us where we are, or so that it advances us in the question, in the face of some social question? Right now we're questioning, do we need to change our policies, and to what extent, through the selection of a president who's either going to continue or modify and continue or radically depart from the policies that this country has right now, not
okay,
only the country
Kurt.
Has, but each one of us on an individual decision-making, day-to-day type of...
Okay, Kurt, we get it. Thank you for the call. We've got to move on because we're almost out of time here, and I want to give Scott Stossel a chance to respond. You've got about 30 seconds.
Well, I agree. You know, change is a big meme, as they say, in politics today and in the Obama campaign. Those who support him say, this is great. Change is what we need. Those who are skeptical are, change for the sake of change is not necessarily a good thing, and it can be dangerous. We do things the way that we do them for a good reason. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the general election.
What's the website for your magazine again?
www.theatlantic.com, and I encourage all your listeners to weigh in with their own top ideas of the year.
Thank you very much for an enjoyable hour of conversation.
Well, thank you.
Scott Stossel is managing editor of The Atlantic Monthly, and you can find out more about these 11 and a half ideas at theatlantic.com. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning and on-air production by John Tretter. If you liked the show, you can go to the radio, call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program 620D. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network.